590 The Fan. Bam, 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 bam. Fan Morning Show, Sports Set 590 The Fan, JD, Blake, and Ailish. Again, Blake going to be moving to a show, Jays Plus, Blue Jays Talk Plus. The names they've come up, like the person, I want the job of the person who gets to name the shows on the station.
The Fan Morning Show.
Fan Drive, Blue Jays Talk. Blue Jays, real Kipper and Bourne. Like whoever's doing this job is I like to picture it's one person, and this is their, like, they got a big office and they keep running into their office and they go, "Name maker, what do you
help
have
us?" For,
yeah, name maker, what do you have? Do you guys know the Jim Gaffigan joke, the Bi Menon joke, where he's like, by Menon, and they're like, good God, he's done it again, right? It's like, that's the same guy naming the names of the show. But Blue Jays. They're heating up. Things are turning around. We said it. Narrative tipping point night. Shohei versus Vladdy. I was tempted to do a billion curse tweets about Shohei Ohtani where I went, this is your MVP. This is the guy. Like, oh, so he pitches. I've seen position players pitch like this. Like, I saw Brett Phillips do it. He gets tuned up when he throws baseballs. Like, position players throw baseballs all the time. It's not that special if you're not good at it. And Shohei Ohtani getting touched up last night by the Blue Jays. But Vladdy takes him yard, takes him over the fence in L.A. near that cool bullpen that they've got there in that ballpark. Yeah, I guess that. How are we feeling about Vladdy right now? Because this is the one shot where you get it and go, well, it's kind of a ball game's out of touch the other night. But this one against Shohei, that meant something to me.
I'm with you. I thought, again, this is, we're looking at the process underlying these results as well, and it's a lot of, hey, Vlad's been laying off the stuff that we want Vlad to lay off of, and that, he has in the first inning, certainly one he'd want back. He missed it by a couple feet.
I know.
It's out of a lot of parks, and that's Ohtani hung that slider. That slider did not slide whatsoever.
He missed that one, Blake, but it still made me feel better that he put it in the air, you know, like he did, like
he
that he put it
yeah.
deep. Yeah, he drove it.
It was promising, yes.
Yeah, and the only real thing you'd have issue with in that plate appearance is that he did swing at 101 in the dirt, but it's 01 and you're Vlad, you get a little bit of benefit of the doubt. But yeah, then he homers in the sixth inning. I liked it. He was sitting on something off speed again, something breaking. That's pretty clear from what he swung at and didn't swing at against Ohtani, that he was not going to try to attack the fastball. And again, he gets one that's left a little bit up in the zone and hammers it down the line. So yeah, I'm encouraged. I'm encouraged by obviously the home runs, but that game he homered the other night, he also had a single and a walk where he worked a good plate appearance. This one, he doesn't walk or have any other hits, but good process at the plate too. I think he's starting to find it. I hope.
Yes, things are looking up for Vladdy, and we talked about it yesterday. What's the narrative we want out of this? Well, I wanted him to one up Ohtani. I wanted him to be the star of the night, and Ohtani still got 10 strikeouts. Great, but they found ways to capitalize on his weaknesses, and I think that was with their approach. And Vladdy looks a little bit like he's dialed in more. And I said it, consecutive games with a home run, first time in the season that he's done that, things are looking up, right? That's a streak. Is it a streak?
Yeah. Well, I think that what is important for a night like last night is that, like, we always do the baseball as an individual sport masquerading as a team sport. But I think it's very clear that part of what has happened to Vladimir Guerrero Jr. to start this season is that he put a little too much pressure on his shoulders to try to carry this team at times. And that's good because he kind of needs to do that. But that's something that, I don't want to say it is like, but it's, and not everybody's the same. Like, just because Mike Trout carried his team offensively to start his career doesn't mean that Vladdy's progression was going to be linear. And I think that losing Teoscar Hernandez and having his buddy Lourdes Gurriel Jr. going through like an absolutely horrific slump, seeing Bo Bichette hitting in front of him for a month where Bo couldn't have an OPS that was over 600, I do think that those things impacted Vladdy a little bit. And I wondered if he sort of just kind of came out of his rhythm a bit, how he was sort of feeling about things. Now it sort of looks like everybody's normalizing to a degree. Even we see a couple of on-base appearances from Gurriel lately. We're seeing
Gurriel, the only guy Shohei didn't strike out last night, by the way. He struck out eight different Jays, everyone but Gurriel.
Yeah, so you see, like, Gurriel starting to do a little bit of something. They've got these two catchers that hit, and I want to talk about that in a second. They got to get more from Teo. Like, obviously, like, that's the kind of last piece of the puzzle to really, because there's a difference between Gurriel and Teoscar Hernandez, and I know we usually lump those two guys together because they're the corner outfielders, and both of them can, like, provide a lot of offense, but Teoscar needs to be, like, all-star level. He was, like, their RBI leader last year. Lourdes Gurriel is kind of a luxury piece where when he's hot, it's awesome. When he's cold, you're supposed to be able to survive it. Either way, Bo has been amazing as of late. He's been much, much better. I just think that Vlad is sort of just settling into the season right now. And I do expect this is a thing to come and that this is going to be better. And honestly, like, the bats, the at-bats that he was having and the ground balls that he was having, because they were so reminiscent of his early struggles in his career, I don't blame people for getting worried, because it's kind of, it seems obvious at this point that it's like we're going to be able to tell when Vladdy's on and when Vladdy's off, and it's literally going to be, is the ball on the ground or is the ball in the air? Like, which one of the two versions are you getting of Vladdy? Ball in the air? You got the stud. You know, guy who's hitting it to opposite field, like poking it around, and he's doing the Ichiro thing where he's so confident that he's hitting the baseball to different areas, then great. But when he's just hitting it to the left side over and over and over again, we're going to know, like, okay, it's time for an adjustment, time to change up the game plan. My hope is that he evolves as a hitter, that those stretches get shorter and shorter and shorter, and that you don't see lengthy ones that last, like, nearly the entire month of May.
Yeah, exactly. That's the hope, right? And that's always the hope for a young player, is like the old Nick Nurse thing is like, okay, can you have one good game? And then can you give us two out of every four? And then can you give us three out of every five? And so on like that. And that's a challenge. It's baseball. It's obviously you're going to ebb and flow. That's why, you know, the focus on what he is and isn't laying off is so important. Whereas, you know, it's funny to compare him to Gurriel, because when Gurriel gets hot historically, it's just like, no, it doesn't matter what you're throwing. He just hits everything for a month.
Yep.
Whereas Vlad, there is a much more process-oriented thing you can look at. And I thought, I know last night wasn't about Springer, but his leadoff home run in that game.
Huge. Set the tone.
Fourth all-time in leadoff home runs. And not only was it a leadoff home run, an eight-pitch plate appearance where he got ahead in the count. He made Ohtani throw his fastball, his slider, and his splitter each a couple times. And look, if you're Vladdy, one of the things that I don't think he's ever said it, but one of the reasons that I think he likes to hit third instead of second, where the analytics might say he should hit, is you get to see a bunch more pitches before you get up to the plate. And that's why they're trying Espinal in the two-hole right now instead of riding with Vlad there. So Springer coming up and having a nine-pitch plate appearance right away, or an eight-pitch plate appearance, rather, right away is really helpful to Vlad, I think. And he got to see everything that was coming his way.
Totally agree. Totally agree. Springer set the tone in that game. It was a great way to start it. I will say quickly that I think it's a good highlight for baseball that Vladdy takes Ohtani, like he takes him deep. But it was a reminder of how that stuff really doesn't play outside of markets, because I went to social media and I just put their names into the old search machines and was like kind of looking around. It's only niche baseball. Like, it wasn't a thing last night on social media, even with baseball. And like I look on Instagram this morning. You guys think about this, like a beautiful play like the McKinnon goal, right? You see that goal everywhere. The Andrew Wiggins dunk on Luka Doncic, you see that everywhere after it happens, right? It's nonstop in your Instagram feed, your Twitter feed, it's everywhere. The Vladdy one I saw come out from the MLB.com account and then some local Toronto accounts, and like that was pretty much the only places that I saw it. I just think we need to stop deluding ourselves that this is ever going to be a thing, or that it ever is a thing outside of the local market.
on the Springer thing, 48th leadoff homer, tying for the fourth most in baseball history already in his career.
Yeah,
that was pretty cool.
It's a great number. It's a really really great number. The batting order thing is really interesting to me because Blake, I'm with you. Like, I lose my mind. I lost my mind when they put Vladdy up in the two hole. I hate that. Like when they were trying to shake things up and they put him up at number two, I'm like, I don't like that so much. But do we like keeping Espinal here? Because I kind of been going back and forth on it, and he got the RBI last night where I went, okay, is this now time to kind of shake things back up and go back to what was working before? But there's something about Bo and cleanup and the way that things are going right now. I don't know. What do you think about the batting order?
Yeah, I like it. It's much more about Bo's placement than anyone else. Mm-hmm. Bo, like I just mentioned, that one of the benefits of Vlad hitting third versus second is that he gets to see more pitches. And Bo, obviously, he didn't adjust anyway to a more conservative approach. But Bo isn't that guy, right? Bo's going out there and he's jumping on stuff early. He's being aggressive, which is great. That's when Bo's at his best. But that type of plate profile and approach profile is better suited, I think, to a 4-5 spot than a table setting spot, where as the table setter, you want competitive at bats. You want guys who can, you know, put the ball in play. And obviously, we're long past the days of you want a speedster leading off and a guy who can bunt them over hitting second. But I do think a guy who has competitive at bats and a guy who can do some, you know, hit and run stuff or things like that is helpful. And Espinal's, you know, on the higher end with this Jays team in terms of how deep do you work into counts? How competitive are your at-bats? Matt Chapman is the only guy on the team seeing more pitches per plate appearance than Espinal is. So again, it plays into the, does this help Vlad? Mostly though, this is a Bo thing to me. And I've always liked Bo better in a cash him in spot than a set him up spot. I just think he's a type of hitter that's better suited there. Now, the issue with having Vlad hit third and Espinal second or whatever is that, yes, over a long stretch, that means Espinal gets more plate appearances than Vlad. But if that's what optimizes and that's where Vlad's most comfortable, you live with that. And Espinal's certainly deserved an opportunity to not hit, you know, 8-9.
And, you know, even JD, he was the top of your power rankings or confidence rankings for quite a while down the stretch. He was one of the only guys hitting well. And I think don't fix what's not broke, right? That's the saying. I think, you know, right now they're getting some confidence with everybody, and I'm happy with him being there until maybe things change. But I think he's been one of the most consistent Blue Jays, and you should reward him a little bit with that. But you know, we'll see how things go. But I do really like the way it looked last night, at least.
Yeah, and it'll look a little better when Teoscar gets going, because that slides Chapman down to 6 or 7, and Toppy is not playing. I thought Biggio last night did the Biggio thing where he had a walk and 3 strikeouts. And
no, the walk, though, is just like... It's Biggio...
Nice play at first base, though, on that big double play. So
Biggio's on the like shortest of leashes for me if I'm the Blue Jays. Like, honest to God.
Like, if he goes to the Vinny Capra role of like, hey, it's 2 weeks and we forgot he's still on the roster, that wouldn't surprise me entirely. The question, though, that is creeping up now is in terms of batting order optimization, the analytics say hit your best player second. Danny Jansen, number two hitter, now that he's the team's best player, another homer last night. And most encouraging, given what we talked to, like we talked to Arden about this yesterday, about Danny Jansen and how a pull-heavy approach kind of helped him unlock some extra power. That was not a cheap pull-side home run last night. That was a monster to pretty deep center field. Good to see him being able to spread that power around a little bit.
Jansen looks terrific. The Jays all of a sudden have, like, we'll see what ends up actually happening. His numbers obviously right now are outrageous. Like, and it's the tiniest of samples, right? But again, you stretch it back to last year and you look at it and you go, like, maybe there is something here. Maybe there is a little bit more to Danny Jansen than we thought there would be. Again, the guy came into the league. Everybody thought that he was going to be an offensive catcher, and then he worked on his defense more. And I've always said, like, his defense is good, but it's always been something where it's like, comparatively to his partners, it gets, I think, a little bit overstated and overrated. He's supposed to be an offensive guy. That's, again, what he started as. I do think that the Jays are in, like, a very luxurious position where, like, you have this guy who September, October last year Boy, like the numbers are astonishing. Like basically, 63 plate appearances, OPS over 1,000. You combine that with this season, OPS over 1,000. You're starting to build a little bit of a sample. I don't think he's that. I think, but if imagine he's a catcher who has an OPS of around 800 plus, you know, like that's huge. That's huge, especially when you have Alejandro Kirk. My question is going to be kind of like, when does the rubber meet the road a little bit though with having three guys in your organization who all might be everyday-ish catchers, depending on whether or not Kirk can hold up. And that's something that I'll probably explore a little later on. I don't think it's an urgent question for this season, but it is kind of one of those things where, like, you've got a lot of depth at one spot that is very coveted around baseball. And, yeah, there were rumors that the Jays were already going to move Kirk in a deal for Ramirez, that was going to be, like, a staple piece. I think that if you're going to get that lefty bat and it's going to be an absolute stud, that one of those three guys is going to be in that trade. And that to me has become like the most obvious movement point for the Jays when it, not to spin a Danny Jansen being great into a weird thing, but it's just, that's what I keep thinking right now. If Danny continues doing this, he's got two more years of control, right? He's not an urgent decision here. The Jays don't need to move him because of a contract, and like they're in a win-now window. They've announced that. We talked to Morosi yesterday. He said that he doesn't see the lefty bat thing happening until the offseason. I would agree that you're not moving Jansen or Kirk or Moreno unless it's a no-doubt-about-it trade that happens in season, which is probably going to be rare. But yeah, it's something I'm thinking about right now.
And yeah, if interested teams are looking in on Moreno, he's had three or more hits in six of his last 12 games. OPSing over 1,000 for the month of May. Maybe not quite as much power as you'd like to see in that necessarily, but when you're hitting that often, it doesn't really matter because those singles and doubles add up. One of those good problems to have, certainly helpful to be able to deal from a position of strength. And as we talked about a little bit yesterday, if at some point they decide to go down to just 13 pitchers and have a 13th bench bat, and versatility-wise, you know, you can. This team has shown they can get three catchers in the mix between the DH spot and, hey, Jansen's going to start, and then you pinch hit for him if it's the wrong matchup, and then you can defensive replace. There's a lot of stuff you can do, but mostly, yeah, enjoy it while it's here, because catcher is also probably the highest position of attrition in terms of a guy falls off or a guy starts to wear and tear. So not a bad problem for now. But yeah, if it's still the three of them closer to the trade deadline, you have to think that's the position they're trying to deal from. I know they have a lot of org depth in the middle infield too, with guys like Otto Lopez and Leo Jimenez and Jordan Groshans. So maybe you can deal from them too. Catcher's a premium trade chip position as well. So you should have some interest, I think.
So with that, it's now time for something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats.
Yum, yum, yum.
The Golden State Warriors are going back to the finals. And the bravado of Draymond Green is back. He's calling out the Boston Celtics, saying the Celtics are coming back. Steph Curry, I do want to talk about him more in terms of like legacy plays, because I think that this is massive for him. I think this is massive for Draymond. It's unfortunately not as big for Klay, and maybe that changes a little bit in the finals if he has some big moments, but it's just very clear that Klay is not the same Klay anymore. The Warriors have done it again. They've gotten back. We talked about it all season long, about how Golden State, if they could do this again, if they could find a way, it was going to be legacy-defining for Steph. I think it's huge. But the guy I can't stop thinking about right now is Andrew Wiggins. And we're about to talk about Canada Basketball a little bit further, because we have the CEO of Canada Basketball, Michael Bartlett, on after the break. Andrew Wiggins, the way he's playing right now, is making me feel very conflicted things. He's someone who I really loved coming into his career. And I will expand on this like further throughout the shows as we like start the finals. Something that you want is just like, how are we feeling about Andrew Wiggins right now? Because Blake, you and I have always said, yeah, you know what, Canada just isn't, it's not a thing anymore caring about Wiggins, because he's had moments, right? Like he made the All-Star team this year, and like he came out of the gates and he was playing really strong. But we invested so much in him, or at least I did, when he went to Kansas, right? He was Maple Jordan. We had the YouTube highlights of him. He goes to Kansas, and his entire tenure at Kansas was extremely disappointing. It was the only reason he goes first overall in the draft is because Embiid gets hurt. And even then, it was a debate whether or not he was supposed to go first overall. He goes first overall. LeBron identifies him right away and like sniffs it out to a certain degree and trades him. Like Le GM, and we know it's Le GM now because Kyrie Irving said so on a podcast like a week ago. Shifts him to Minnesota. He really doesn't develop much there. He scores points, but it's not efficient. His defense never really shows up. He gets accused by multiple different players and people around the organization as a guy who got the bag and didn't really work too hard. He signed a massive shoe deal, which I think is one of the more regrettable shoe deals in history. Like, I don't know a single person that bought the Wiggins shoe.
and you're not repping in peak?
Well, he signs a contract that kind of universally becomes known as the worst contract in basketball. He gets traded for another bad contract to the point where it's a D'Angelo Russell move, and the Timberwolves had to throw in an asset. They had to throw in a first-round pick to move the guy. He shows up in Golden State, and we all were optimistic of, okay, well, maybe this is going to be the thing that works for him. And then it sort of does. And it's kind of inconsistent. There are times where it's not quite all the way there, but eventually, here, in the biggest moments, Andrew Wiggins looks like truly a top, I don't know, 40 player in the NBA this series. Like, I'm trying not to be overly aggressive with it, but he's looked phenomenal. Like, really, the defense all of a sudden has shown up. He's everywhere defensively. The athleticism, the rim attacking, some of the shooting, all of the Andrew Wiggins pieces are kind of starting to fall together. And no, he's not Maple Jordan, and he's not the first overall pick or the prince that was promised or any of those major things. But his career is rounding out into a place where I am kind of curious what the investment will be from Canadian basketball fans, especially as he gets into a series with Boston that a lot of Raptors fans have feelings about, and he goes up head-to-head with Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown and has a major role potentially in a series against those guys. And yeah, the Heat could advance, but I think I'm with Draymond on that they're going to be playing the Boston Celtics. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I am kind of curious whether or not, again, we talk about narrative tipping points a lot on the show. Wiggins had a big summer with Canada Basketball in Victoria. He showed up. He's not on this list of 14 guys that have committed to 3 years. He's obviously a bit of an odd duck. He's a different bird. But, yeah, I wonder if this is going to, like, I wonder if we just end up in a really positive place with Andrew Wiggins after all. And if we end up looking back on his career, if he can win a championship here and roll this into, like, a successful tenure to close out with the Warriors and then join Canada Basketball, if it's kind of going to be like, yeah, not everybody's at the same time, and some people are late bloomers, and maybe Wiggins is a late bloomer for the way that people in this country feel about him, or if it's just too late and the die is already cast.
I don't think it's too late. He's still only 20. He just turned 27. There's lots of time ahead. Yeah, I think this is great for Wiggins. He was obviously ecstatic last night celebrating that conference championship. I'm super happy for him. And I think that this is an example of, well, first of all, don't write guys off right away if they struggle out of the gate, but more so, like, the crown of being a number one pick is heavy, and the crown of being a guy that someone's attaching the future of the franchise to is heavy, where, no, Wiggins hasn't lived up to being the number one pick, but he's been a good basketball player, and he's been really good with Golden State. Some guys are just best cast being a number three, where, hey, the points you're getting are a little easier because the defensive attention is elsewhere, and what that lets you do is focus on your defense, focus on secondary playmaking, take a more efficient approach to your shot profile. Like, a big change with Wiggins as a role player has been he's shooting 39% on threes the last 2 years after not even being an average shooter in any of his six seasons before that. So that's huge in terms of your role. I just think some guys are, you know, best cast in this kind of situation. It's a great, great, great fit for him. And this was kind of the hope as a Canadian basketball fan when he got traded there was, hey, no one is asking Andrew Wiggins to score 25 points a game anymore and take 20 shots a game. He can be a version of himself that his skill set is better suited to. So this is great. It's nice to see him that happy. Hopefully, we'll eventually see him back in a Canadian senior men's team uniform.
I got complicated feelings about him, I will admit. That's still,
of course.
Like, it's not straightforward for me. And I will admit that I think I'm a little different than some. Like, I watched every one of his games at Kansas. Mm-hmm. That's how invested I was in Wiggins. Every one of them. They were on tape delay, and I would record them. They would be on the other network at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I would make sure that they were taped, and I would get up in the morning, and they would be it would be the first thing I would watch. And it was just like, time and time again, it was a disappointment. And yeah, like this buy-in, you're right. Like, don't write guys off until later. But this is kind of – he had to fall into the perfect situation too. Like, I just – I think that there are some things about it that will still always irk me. There's something about missing out on potential that is in some ways the worst, right? Because it's like you see people who maximize their gifts, and he's there with Draymond Green, who's a maximizes his gifts guy, right? And that is something I think in sports that we really admire and that we celebrate. But when the guys who have all the gifts and don't take advantage of them, and it's kind of like year over year over year over year over year, and then all of a sudden Andrew Wiggins is 28 years old and he's been paid max money and now he's on the Warriors, and it's like, okay, so now you're going to invest and kind of play a little differently once you're in a conference final. I don't – like, again, he's making me feel something, and I'm feeling positive and nostalgic and hopeful about Andrew Wiggins, but it also does like kind of confirm some of the things that were so – deadly about the early portions of his career, which is like this was never an issue of ability or like can do. It was always the question of heart and mind and mm-hmm. buy-in.
I think there's some maturing that happened, and I also think I love a good redemption story, a good redemption mm-hmm. arc, a comeback. And I think that that's exactly the opportunity that he's in, especially if he's able to kind of get in that Canada basketball system and really show that he's got that buy-in, that he cares about that background that he comes from. And I think that's something we can ask our next guest as well. We have Michael Bartlett, who's the CEO of Canada Basketball, on next. And we're going to talk about, you know, the new legislations that they've put in with the 14 players deciding to be a part of it. So let's take a break. And we'll get to that on the other side of the break. It's the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
The Fan Morning Show, Sports at 590, The Fan, Blake Murphy, J.D. Bunkus, Ailish Forfar. Just talking about Andrew Wiggins before the break. He was not on a list of 14 senior men's national Canada basketball team players who have committed to the next three-year cycle, but he's a notable absence. But more notable than any absence is just how many guys have committed to this next three-year window as Canada tries to make the Olympics again.
I was just going to say our next guest is probably like, really, guys, we just got that commitment and we're going to start with who's not there still?
Yeah. Like, I'm trying to transition list? For yeah, the podcast
I
listeners.
I know.
From one segment to the next.
And we do want to know. I just think it was funny.
And hey, it was very positive about a Canadian basketball standard, Andrew Wiggins. And obviously there are a million reasons that guys can or can't commit to 3 years at a time. But a remarkable list of guys who did commit gives you a lot of faith that this Olympic cycle will be the one that the Canadian senior men's team qualifies through and competes through. To help us talk about that and a bunch of other Canada basketball stuff, including Global Jam, which we'll tell you a little bit more about. It's a sports site in Canada basketball co-venture. It's the CEO of Canada Basketball, Michael Bartlett. How are you this morning?
Morning. Very well, Blake. How are you?
Doing well. So you guys have the press conference this week. You roll out the list of 14 names that are committed for the three-year window as the summer core, in addition to that larger winter core of players you've pulled from through for in-season qualifiers. Just how big a moment for the Canadian basketball program is that, to have that on paper, to have that message set, to have those names that you can plan on being there not once, but three summers in a row?
Well, yeah, Blake, I agree. It is a big moment, and we are doing things differently. And this signals that, you know, the expectations that we're quite clearly laying out for our athletes, male and female, and what, you know, our ambitions are and what their role needs to be to achieve those. You know, the three-year commitment is something that we've asked for before from our winter or summer players. The focus on consistency has been, you know, something that we've learned the hard way over the last number of competitions. And it's what wins in FIBA ball. It is what wins. You're not just stacking your 12 best to compete in an all-star game against USAB. It's about beating the world. And they have these rosters that have been playing together time and time again. We need to mirror that because we got to get through the world to get to U.S. And I'm happy with the rollout, but we're all just focused on the performance. This is, you know, quite frankly, a great list, but now we've got to hit the court and win the way that we know how. And that's what we'll be judged on. And that's what we should be judged on.
So you said two things there that I'm curious about. One is that, okay, so you've already asked people for three-year commits, and that didn't happen in the past, and now you, like, you're doing things differently. So where did that begin? What was the first major change for you guys that you really felt started to change the momentum for this program? Because it really does feel like the momentum has changed quite drastically over the last couple of years.
Well, JD, the buzzer in Victoria, I think, was probably the start of that that awakening and change. You know, we had some real tough conversations as a group, as a leadership team. You know, Nick and Rowan are doing an amazing job just really dissecting what the international basketball competitive advantages need to be, and one of those is consistency. So we had some conversations as a group. Then we actually we had some player-only discussions combined with player and management discussions down in Summer League in Vegas last year. And there was a real understanding of what it was going to take from every individual on our men's program. And, you know, quite frankly, the women's program has benefited from consistency for decades. Their rosters that they've competed with internationally have shown the benefit of that consistency. So we can learn a lot from the women's program as well on the men's side, and we're enacting that now.
Michael, another thing that stands out on the women's side recently is that head coach Victor LaPena is now going to be the full-time, year-round senior women's national team coach.
Yes.
Between that and the men's team being coached by Nick Nurse's key assistants in Nathaniel Mitchell and Nate Bjorkgren, how big a part of that consistency of coaching and messaging, like how big is that to this plan? Because obviously the players are nice, but that consistent messaging, consistent scheme, and consistent presence feels like it's just as big a deal for you guys.
Yeah, and it's a great point. The having a full-time head coach, not something that we've ever had at Canada Basketball. A lot of the leading federations do on their women's program specifically. And then having a top caliber coach, a global winner like Victor, move him and his family to Canada to be a part of this program, that signifies something. And then from a systems consistency standpoint, you've got on the men's side, Nick, with Nate and Nate. And then we've got this, you know, opportunity with that system, as again, on the women's side as well, with Victor as a head coach, to start teaching our style of play to the senior team, to the primary roster, to the development roster, you know. And then you look at what we're doing with Global Jam, their hands that are going to be over the selection of our under 23 roster and the style of play that those players play, it's all going to connect. And I've, you know, we are running to Paris 2024. We got to get through the World Cup first, but this is also setting us up for the World Cup in 27, LA Olympics in 28. Like this is about the long game here. We can play the long game. Our athletes are not going to be free agents. They're Canadian. We're not going to lose them to a trade. They're Canadian. So we got to teach this system the right way from the start.
I love that. And one of the first things I thought of with, hey, if this commitment, this is a very public commitment, even though you've asked for them privately before, if this works and if things keep moving in the right direction, you almost get to a point where you don't need the firm commitments because it's just understood that if you're part of the program, you better be there every summer because you're going to be behind otherwise, or you might not, you know, the language around these 14 guys of, hey, these are the guys we'll draw the roster from unless things change. I guess my question, it's not really a question, I'm just kind of sharing my take on it, is this a culture change as much as it is a basketball change, where I know that there's been great commitment at the junior levels and at the women's level, but kind of trying to establish that if you're in this program, you're in this program, and there's no, you know, kind of moonlighting or swooping in here and there?
Yeah, but we owe them something for that as well. And, you know, it is about culture change, and it's how we give them as athletes as much reason to be proud of their program association as they are their nationality. We want them to be, they are proud Canadians. That's why they show up. We want them to be proud Canada basketball program athletes. We have to deliver pro-level experiences from training, to coaching, to resourcing for them. We have to give them brag-worthy experiences that they can go home and talk to their family about when they're not playing with us and say, you should see the run I just had with Canada Basketball. Or they go back in their pro locker room and talk about the run they just had with us. We have to give them great experiences and give them opportunities to win as well as a team in order for them to feel that loyalty. So our value exchange in that is very important too.
So, Michael, you mentioned Global Jam, and I mentioned it coming in as well. So a little background here for anyone who hasn't heard yet or isn't sure what it is. Sportsnet and Canada Basketball are teaming up to host Global Jam, which is an under-23 men's and women's tournament. It'll take place July 5th to 10th at Mattamy Athletic Center here in Toronto. People can visit basketball.ca/globaljam. No A in the global, so it's G-L-O-B-L-J-A-M. Really exciting kind of U23 men's and women's tournament with teams coming in from a handful of different countries and the potential to really grow this. Sportsnet and Canada Basketball are working on this all together. It'll be available on Sportsnet to watch. And before we get into what this means to Canada Basketball, how it's a part of things, Michael, you've given me permission to announce some of the names that are going to be on the Canadian rosters for these U23 teams.
Yeah, please
so
do.
On the men's side, we can confirm Texas senior Marcus Carr, who I'm sure Canadian basketball fans are aware of. He's been high on the NCAA radar for a long time. Ryan Nembhard from Creighton, who our producer Daniele has known since he was a little baby on a Fisher-Price hoop. Charles Bediako, who we saw pretty recently in the U19s. Tyrese Samuel from Seton Hall. And then on the women's side, absolutely loaded, Shidae Wilson from Duke, who was the ACC Freshman of the Year and is maybe one of the best young women's talents we've produced in forever. Letitia Amaher, who is at South Carolina and had an NCAA championship run this year. Shayna Pellington from Arizona. Aaliyah Edwards from UConn and Marissa Russell from Louisville. Man, I know there's more rosters to come, but I don't think you're going to be able to match that for a wave of names as big as this first one.
Well, we've been laughing, around the office, and I've been actually, well, maybe it hasn't been a laughing moment. I've been saying to our teams, like, we're not going through all this work to create this brand new event to show off in front of home soil to go in and dog it. Like, let's go win. And we've got the athletes to do that. This next generation who aren't household names yet, perhaps. What I love about this tournament is that we can help make them household names. And they were all, like, both our men's and women's program athletes for U23, they're all draft ready. They're all next. And this is a great opportunity to give them a chance. They have not, like the five female athletes you just mentioned have never played for their country on home soil. That can never happen again. So our commitment to the athletes about program loyalty is also giving them these opportunities.
That's awesome. So in terms of Global Jam, obviously the hey, play for your national team on your home soil is a big part of it. This locks in a youth event in Canada every year if it goes well. How does this play into the larger Canada basketball strategy of continuing to grow the game, continuing to grow these athletes and you know, I guess have a more tactile and closer touch for a lot of fans as they watch these players develop?
Yeah, certainly. And it's when it goes well, not if, when it goes well.
Sorry.
the reality is we're running out of teams for our athletes to make. The talent pool is so deep in this country now that they're aging out of the U19s, which is, you know, the last official age group for FIBA. And a lot of these athletes don't have a chance to make our senior team, just talent for talent-wise, until they're 23, 24, 25. So that, at least, what, 4 or 5 years of them not having a team to play on to represent their country. So the U23 program is something that we're developing with an eye towards, you know, pipeline maturity and the strength that we have, but also other federations are doing this too. The best of the best are recognizing that this age group has kind of been forgotten as basketball has taken off around the world. And so a number of us have started under 23 development programs. And now this tournament can be the culmination of great best on best for the next generation. And we think it'll be a fire starter for the entire global basketball scene as well.
I have to ask a personal favor, Michael. So this is U23. I think we need a 36 and up version of this as well. I would like to play. And look, I was watching the CEBL game last night. He's not there yet, but maybe if we get him in the development program, we could naturalize 37-year-old J. Cole as part of the program as well, because I know you guys have this extended partnership with CEBL as well. which is, you know, part of this same strategy.
Yeah, we made some great announcements with Mike Morreale, the CBL commissioner, on Tuesday as part of our roster rollout as well. So we are leaning into more events together. We are going to work a lot more in tandem on creating player pathways. As I just mentioned, you know, the CBL becomes an excellent home playing opportunity for our athletes as they develop. We've got 32 athletes from our program in their league this year. And then a lot more work together on equity, diversity, and inclusion as well. We recognize there are still gaps. You know, basketball identifies as a very diverse sport, and it is, both in who plays it and who watches it. But there's still so many barriers that hold access back, and even, you know, more so in officiating and coaching and, you know, being an executive of the league. So we're going to work in tandem on that stuff too.
So I got to tell you, if you have Blake Murphy on your 36 and older Canada basketball team, the commitment issues are they're back. They're horrible. Like, it's like you can't if you can't beat out Blake on a 36 man team. There's going to be a real summit. People are going to be calling for your job. It's not going to be a good look for you, Michael. It's going to be bad. All of this sounds so great, man. And honestly, like, obviously, as Canada basketball fans, this is just such great momentum, and everyone's thrilled with the future of this program and where things are going, the commitment level, all of the different things that you've outlined in this. But we did talk about Biggins in the last break, and just how there is this complicated relationship if you're a Canadian basketball fan with this player, because, man, he got nicknamed Maple Jordan. We went through the entire history of this guy, whether it was Kansas and watching tape delay games and then showing up in the NBA and all of a sudden having to watch a Minnesota we thought was going to be Team Canada with him and Anthony Bennett for a while. But where is the program with Wiggins? Because he is the most notable absence from this list of committed players.
Yeah, JD, it's a great question, and the program is and Andrew's relationship is strong. The reality of the situation is that with what we are asking for these athletes, it's kind of a ride or die scenario. Come with us to Paris or don't come with us at all. That puts players in a position to have to make a choice. And Nick and Andrew have forged a strong relationship through their OQT tournament time in Victoria and since. And Nick has talked to him, and Andrew said, Coach, I want to be a part of this program. I want to be a part of a win. I cannot sign up for 3 years. I do not know what every summer is going to look like, and that's a personal choice that I'm making. And we respect that. What we want from a program is yes or no. We cannot live with maybe anymore, and our country does not deserve maybe from us anymore. We need to be a winner, and therefore we have to be yes or no as well. So it's a great relationship with Andrew, and it's so great that it's an honest relationship with Andrew, and we were able to get to a point of honesty that if there isn't a spot available now, you know, you're not guaranteed on this roster. You've made that choice. We've made our expectations clear, and everybody is happy with the honesty that came from that conversation.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I would say, too, that I will always believe, and this has always been a contention for me with international basketball, is like guys kind of passing up this opportunity to play, I think has been, a little bit overlooked in terms of the benefits that you can have for certain players. And for a guy like Wiggins, who had that summer with Canada basketball, I do think that helped, in part anyways, propel what he has done this season, what he's doing right now. And I guess just sort of the follow-off of this question, though, is simply, so what is the level of flexibility then? Because you're right, like, it's ride or die, and you guys have to set this, you kind of have to set this, like, hey, this is what it's going to be. We don't want to be unfair to the other players. But, yeah, if a guy of that talent level kind of comes to you last minute and is like, hey, well, is there a spot for me? Yeah, how do you balance those two things where you go, we want to be flexible, we want to maintain our relationships, but also we need to stand firm in order to keep the program in the direction that we feel it needs to go?
Yeah, and I think what you're going to hear and see from our program is we're going to stick to what we've said. We're going to stick to the promises we've made to the 14 who have made promises to us. Don't forget, there's also a winter core of, you know, a pool of about 20 athletes that played for us over two pools that are learning this system as well. So when you start to think about dropping a player into the system, you know, who might be injured injured from the core 14, it might be smarter for us to pull from the winter 20 than it would be to drop, somebody in fresh that hasn't been with the system, over these periods of months and years. So, you know, we will stick to our promises. Our coaching staff and Rowan and our executive leadership team on the men's side is doing this differently, and fully support them for for sure.
Really looking forward to what these next couple years look like, Michael. Really looking forward to Global Jam, July 5th to 10th at Mattamy Athletic Center in Toronto as well. And again, basketball.ca/Global Jam, no A in Global Jam. Michael Bartlett, CEO of Canada Basketball, thanks so much for taking the time this morning, and keep giving us reasons for optimism and excitement.
Awesome. Thank you both. I really enjoyed it. I'll come back anytime.
Michael Bartlett, CEO of Canada Basketball. A lot to digest there. It sounds like there is a very long-term, very specific plan in place for how to get the Canadian men's national team performing at the international level the way they have all performed and grown individually.
Quickly, because we have to break, but I do want your thoughts on that. Because, again, the Canada basketball has never been in a position that's this good. Like, their field is deep, and it allows events like Global Jam to take place, right? Like, the next generation coming up on both the men's and women's side is very, very deep. But people do care about the now. And I did think that the most interesting thing from that personally was that to me read as Wiggins isn't playing unless somebody ends up dropping out, or there's like a pretty drastic shift. Like, they're going to hold firm to this. And I do think that that's important in terms of the way that things have been. Like, in order to ensure this, like, you're not Team USA, right? Like, you have to have, if they're going to say that this is going to be different, then I really think that you're going to have to hold firm on those two things. Like, was that your read there too?
Yeah, I think so. And look, let's be honest. That core 14, you're probably hoping for 8 or 9 to be available each summer tournament, because injuries and free agency and insurance stuff, all that stuff happens. And the program recognizes that, which is why there's the winter core as well. It's going to be really fascinating, though, to see the first time that happens. Do they let a Wiggins type back in, a Brandon Clark type back in, or do they pull from the winter core? Because you could make an argument both ways in terms of performance versus what the long-term messaging is here. I would hope that they lean toward the winter core.
And Blake, I was just going to say, we know that those guys, you and I both know that those guys in the winter core have been pissed off in the past in terms of like the herky-jerky nature of this, when they're like doing whatever they want. And they're at their beck and call, and they're leaving their teams in Europe, or they're adjusting their schedules for Canada basketball, and then all of a sudden the program ends up kind of feeling like it's leaving some of their interests in the dust if an NBA guy does show up who hasn't been committed to the program the same way. So I do think this is also a nod to the guys that have really helped establish this foundation. But the Kevin Pangoses of the world.
Melvin Edgem is also on that core 14. I know, Carlton, but the scrubs are longtime parts of that program, right? And even a guy like Kyle Wilcher, who, had a cup of coffee in the NBA, but most of his career is being defined by his performance overseas and coming through for Canada so often. So really exciting time, really looking forward to all that. Let's take a break. Also exciting is to hear our buddy Kipper talk about a Canadian team that, you know, he wasn't too happy with how the Leafs ended, and Edmonton doing some of the things he would have liked the Leafs to do. We'll talk to Nick Kyprios next on the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.